The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to Capital Thinking today. We've got another good show for you guys. Despite a couple of initial technical difficulties there, we're going to start off by talking about the Supreme Court nomination fight that is gripping Washington here in early June, with the president announcing his nominee just last week. And then we're going to spend about 30 minutes talking about energy policy, the status of climate change legislation in the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and also what the president's trip abroad means for the energy sector. We're going to talk then about some of the hot issues also going on the Hill that aren't energy or the Supreme Court nomination. But our guest here for the first segment is longtime Capital Thinking contributor Nick Allard, the co-chairman of the Public Policy Department at the law firm of Patton Boggs. Nick, welcome back. How are you today?
Just fine. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Well, Nick, we were chatting just a moment ago that you, I believe, went to school with the current Supreme Court justice nominee, and I guess the place to start is tell us how things are going as she makes her initial tour on the Hill.
Well, she couldn't be doing any better, as a matter of fact, and interestingly, the press seems to be her best friend to the extent that they turn out more and more information about her rulings and her background. I mean, there was an incredible piece today talking about her work for many years as a prosecutor, when she just started as a tough prosecutor and a, you know, fair, even-handed prosecutor working in New York City for low pay and, you know, defending victims of crime. And then there's another article out about a ruling of hers on gun control, and noting that her opinion in Maloney versus Cuomo on a gun control case was cited and approved. The judges said, we agree with Maloney in the Seventh Circuit, and the opinion there was written by very conservative judge Frank Easterbrook and was joined by other Republican judges, including Richard Posner. So it's going to be real hard, you know, not only dealing with her resume and her qualifications and so on, it's going to be hard for Republicans to deal, you know, paint her as, you know, anti-gun, liberal, loose on crime and things. I mean, I think they'll be very comfortable substantively with her in many areas, which reflects really her approach to the law and her background.
Well, it seems like other than the affirmative action case out of the Northeast that is pending before the Supreme Court and which will be decided before her confirmation, that they don't seem to have, the opposition doesn't seem to have latched on to any particular ruling of hers. Most of what you see in the initial opposition come from a speech she gave a few years ago where she talked about the qualifications of a Latina woman perhaps being better suited than a white woman to make judicial rulings. How do you see that battle? Has that battle sort of now died out, or do you think it will continue as the nomination rolls forward?
I think there's zero chance that she will not be confirmed. I think she's going to get probably 80 or more votes, broad bipartisan support. The only things that have given anyone any heartburn are thin gruel indeed. The affirmative action decision that you talk about, which involved promotion, advancement, and testing for firefighters in New Haven. What judge who's written dozens and dozens of opinions haven't had one decision or another that people take issue with? But the fact and the beauty of our judicial system is that it's subject to reversal on appeal if it's not the law of the land. And, you're not on your own. There's other judges that have to join you in the opinion. And so it's not as if it's a flawed decision that's out of any kind of a mainstream basis of law. You may disagree with it. I really don't think that decision, although some folks may strongly disagree with it, is going to create much of a problem at all for her. And, the other statements are statements which she's already ably, explained, and I don't think are going to be very tough. The fact is that she's just as Justice Roberts was, and our fellow alum from Princeton, Sam Alito, was. I was in the same era as both of them. Alito's a little older, but we overlapped, and Sonia was there a little bit later. But, they're extremely well qualified, and it's going to be very difficult for the opposition to spend much time. Also, Harry Reid, the majority leader, has said that between now and Labor Day, the only thing basically that the Senate is going to do is Sotomayor and health care, those two things.
And right, although he stopped short today, Nick, of actually guaranteeing that they would wrap up her nomination on the floor before they broke in August.
Well, the longer that the Republicans keep her in the spotlight, the better it is for the Democrats, because it elevates the presidency and the Democrats to have a candidate of her caliber, and it's appealing to Americans, and appealing to be dilatory, it doesn't benefit. And also, part of the problem that Republicans will have in opposing her is basically what they would be saying to Hispanic voters is, it doesn't matter how good you do. You can go to the best schools in the country, you can get the top award, the Pine Prize at Princeton, you can be on selected on a blind basis to be on the Yale Law Journal. But that's not good enough. You're not qualified, and I don't think they're going to want to do that. In fact, I don't think they feel that way. I think she's going to have justifiably strong support from both parties, as she deserves. And she's been battle tested. She's been approved. That's another thing. We talked about this before. She's been through the confirmation process twice. She lives off her judicial paycheck. It's not as if she has any financial conflicts or any kind of questions about her financial background.
She'll
be readily
approved. Isn't President Obama, though, sort of subject to the standard he set in reviewing Roberts and Alito? I mean, he made a very famous, well-documented speech opposing John Roberts' nomination, saying that he was eminently qualified, but that he just looked into the judge's heart, essentially, and didn't think that the judge was for the little guy. I mean, doesn't that give Republicans an opening to say it doesn't have to do with her credentials and the fact she's been appointed and confirmed before? If we don't think that she's going to rule the way we like, well, we're just not going to vote for her.
Well, David Broder today had a very thoughtful piece along those lines today in the Washington Post, and he noted that door might have been opened by the president by his statement on his vote for the Chief Justice, saying that I agree with him probably on 95%, but it's the other 5%. However, here's the problem. The problem is that Sotomayor's track record and her judicial approach on many, many issues, Republicans will find they're very comfortable and they're completely consistent, whether it's gun control, as we just talked about that case, or business, and certainly tough on crime. And so she's not sort of an easy to predict knee-jerk liberal on any particular way or any particular line of cases. And I can tell you from knowing her and from reviewing her work that her approach is not only very methodical, but she takes each case on its own bottom, analyzes the facts, and applies the law. And I think that the folks that know her and the scholars who have analyzed her work would say that it comes out. So I think it's going to be very difficult, even applying the Obama standard, Republicans to take issue with her.
I agree. I don't think there's any chance that they'll derail this nomination. In fact, I suspect that she will have about 70 to 75 votes to get through. That's what I'm projecting. You mentioned earlier that you thought Democrats benefited from the longer this hung out there. When we talked a couple weeks ago before her name came up, and you accurately predicted that she was going to be the nominee, just as our podcast February 9th predicted she would be the nominee, one of the things you made a point of saying was that it may actually help Republicans to run out the clock this summer and use all the...
Well, that's the other side of it, right. Sure. I mean, that's quite right. And I think it's both in terms of the politics... I think Republicans are hurt and Democrats are benefited the longer that she's strung out, and if the opposition looks like it's merely partisan and dilatory, because after all, even if the delay, I mean, she's going to be on the court and the term starts in October, so you might as well get her ready and enable her to get ready for the cases. On the other hand, we're running out of time, and so it's probably, you know, the Democrats in the White House want to have as much time as possible to move health care reform, energy reform, other major pieces of legislation. And it may be in the Republicans' interest to be as thorough and take as long and run out the clock, because not because of the Sotomayor nomination, but because of they have so little other ways to stop the steamroller of the ambitious Obama, Pelosi, Reid domestic legislative agenda that's coming down the pike. So
Let's assume that we got about a minute till break here, Nick. Let's assume that she's a done deal. All indications, again, are it's a matter of when, not if, and what the margin of victory is. Who's the next Supreme Court nominee for President Obama? Because he's probably going to have another one as soon as next year.
Well, I think the Seventh Circuit judge, and I'm just blanking on her name right now.
Diane Wood?
Yeah, Wood, exactly. I think that she's... got to be a very strong contender.
Knows Obama, taught on the faculty with him at Chicago?
Well, and, you know, she's from Chicago. She's a very able judge. She's extremely well qualified.
Well, we'll have to take her name as your next prediction, Nick. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about energy policy here on Capital Thinking.
Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORAKID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live.
live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Well, President Obama's focused on three issues this summer. One is that we just talked about, is getting his Supreme Court nominee confirmed, hopefully before the October 1st start of the new court term. Then second is health care reform, and then third is climate change legislation. We spent a lot of time the last few weeks talking about health care reform, so we're going to turn our attention back for the next half hour to talk about the status of climate change legislation and energy issues in general in Congress and the Obama administration. Joining us as our guest is a frequent contributor to the show, Jeff Turner. Jeff, like Nick Allard, who was just on in the last segment, is the co-chairman of the Public Policy Group at the law firm of Patton Boggs here in D.C. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you, Kevin.
Well, let's start from the 50,000-foot level. What's going on in Congress, the current status of climate change legislation there?
Well, as I'm sure most of your guests have read in the newspaper, just before Memorial Day, the House Energy and Commerce Committee produced a nearly 1,000-page bill. And in fact, by the time the lawyers are done doing all the cross-references and including all of the amendments that were agreed to, we could soon see a final version of the bill that will be greater than 1,000 pages in length.
Just some light reading
for people who want to know how Congress is tackling the climate change issue and taking steps to implement the administration's green energy agenda. So the committee completed its work on the timeline laid out by Chairman Waxman, namely to get a bill introduced and marked up by the Memorial Day recess. There are at least a half dozen other committees in the House of Representatives that now will wish to leave their imprint on the bill. The Speaker of the House yesterday indicated that she will give those committees until June 19th to make their suggested revisions.
That doesn't sound like much time. That sounds like a swift kick in the pants at the other committees.
That's not a lot of time for the committees. I think the sense is that most other committees are quite familiar with the broad outlines of what the Energy and Commerce Committee has been doing for the last couple of months. And so none of the changes made to the bill when it was marked up or the underlying bill will have come to as much of a surprise, and perhaps that's an explanation for why the other committees are being given less time. I think there's another factor here, which is, as you know, the president has made it clear that he's keenly interested in getting a health care bill enacted this year by October. The House Energy and Commerce Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, both of which have jurisdiction over climate change, also have jurisdiction over health care. So
right.
In part, this may be driven, the schedule may be driven by a desire to free those committees to free them up to focus on health care.
Well, Ways and Means especially is going to have challenges figuring out how to finance both of those major changes in domestic policy. But I want to go back to your issue of these other committees that have a role in the bill now that Energy and Commerce has finished their markup on the House side. There's been a lot of attention paid to Colin Peterson from Minnesota, who's the chairman of the Agriculture Committee, who made some claims right before the recess that he had a block of Democrats from the Ag Committee and from rural states that gave him enough power to demand some rewrites to the bill, even though the rewrites he was looking for weren't in under the agriculture's area of jurisdiction. You can tell us a little bit about what his concerns are and
yes,
what might
his major
there?
Concern, and that is shared by many members of his committee, is a concern about whether the Environmental Protection Agency has been taking action that will make it less likely that ethanol would be part of our fuels transportation future. The EPA has been looking at the so-called life cycle emissions involved in the production of ethanol, concerned that on the part of Chairman Peterson and other of his fellow committee members that the work underway by EPA will eliminate or substantially reduce the future for ethanol in the United States. As you can imagine, that's a very important issue to members from the Midwest, especially from corn-growing states. And I would guess that when the Ag Committee makes its recommendations to the bill, that you will see amendments that will eliminate or substantially curtail the EPA's authority to further assess ethanol's life cycle emissions.
Very interesting.
Now, there will be other concerns that they'll look at as well. That's the one that's the most in the news. The other concern is that farmers and ranchers are very concerned that the effect of the legislation will be to substantially increase the cost of fertilizer, the cost of fuel to produce crops, and so they're going to be looking for some sort of help in addressing higher input costs for producing food and raising cattle, for example. The other concern they have is whether they might be able to, or they'd be precluded from offering up vacant or put land into fallow so that they can get emission offsets. They'd like to see agricultural land benefit in some way, just as forest land that is not subject to deforestation may offer credits to reduce an emitting entity's obligations under the statute.
I see. Well, listen, I know when the funding remains a big issue, when they started this process, the idea was going to be they were going to auction off all of the credits under the cap and trade
yes.
program. But now, in a series of compromises, it seems that a great deal of them are going to go to the industries that are most impacted by this legislation. How does that impact the ability to sort of pay for these changes if you're the Ways and Means Committee? And it seems like some groups on the left are particularly concerned that large polluters are essentially going to be given free credits to continue emitting CO2 in the future.
Well, you've certainly read their literature. During the campaign, the president and the vice president, as part of their energy plan, called for 100% auctioning of allowances from day one, in their words, to make polluters pay. But the challenge of legislating has led Chairman Waxman to conclude and produce a bill with his committee that would provide that 85% of the allowances that would be made available from the beginning would be given away for free, with only 15% to be auctioned. As a result of the change in the focus on that issue, you're right, there are some environmental organizations that are very disappointed. I think this just simply reflects the challenge of putting together a bill that takes into account different interests and different geography of the committee, and members from a variety of states outside of California and Massachusetts have needs that Chairman Waxman has tried to address. In the end, to your question, well, who pays? How do you raise the revenue? Well, you simply don't spend the revenue, and then you know, if you don't have auction allowances, revenues coming from those auctions, then you don't have money to spend. And so the concern is from some municipalities, state and local governments, consumer groups, that money that they thought would be available is not going to be available now. And that will create pressure to increase the percentage of allowances auctioned from the beginning. So we've got a long way to go to sort out that battle.
Now, you mentioned this bill's over 1,000 pages on the House side. Before we've gotten the other committees taking a crack at it before. Ways and Means have added the revenue raisers that will need to go in there. And before you get to amendments on the floor, is there a point, if you're the Republicans, are you strategizing to try and find amendments that can peel off enough votes to put something on there that becomes somewhat of a poison pill? Or
yes.
Is that just not feasible?
I think that will be the aim. I'm not sure it's feasible, though. When the committee took up the bill before Memorial Day, Republicans offered a series of amendments trying to force members to take tough votes. In almost every case, those amendments were voted down, frequently on a straight party line vote. My guess is you'll see pretty much the same result when the bill gets to the House floor, which could be just before or just after the July 4th recess. I think what you will see Republicans doing beyond suggesting amendments is making the case, in their view, that this legislation represents a huge tax increase on American business and on American consumers. And I think their hope will be that they can win this battle in the court of public opinion rather than the battle on the floor with amendments.
Well, now we've got just a couple of minutes before break here. Tell me, on the Senate side, they haven't been as ambitious in getting off the mark here, but there's been some progress on renewables legislation in the Energy Committee?
Correct. The Senate has decided to take a wait-and-see attitude towards climate change. They really want to see what the House can agree to before the Senate does anything. In the interim, Chairman Bingaman, Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, has spent the better part of a couple months putting together a bill that focuses solely on energy issues, mostly renewable energy. The goal there is to implement parts of the President's green energy agenda, including requiring greater use of renewables in the production of electricity in the United States, as well as addressing the siting of new transmission lines across the country, dealing with the threat of cybersecurity impact it could have on the transmission grid.
We'll be back in just a minute with more on energy policy here with Jeff Turner on Capital Think.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, your point, Capital Thinking. We are having a great discussion today with Jeff Turner, co-chair of the public policy department at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. Our topic is the pending climate change bill in the House of Representatives. We talked a little bit in the last segment about what's in those 1,000-plus pages of the House document that may soon come to the floor, and we had just wrapped up talking about the Senate. Jeff, was there anything else on sort of the Senate side strategy and timeline?
Well, the Senate, as I said, is taking a wait-and-see attitude. As you may recall, it was the Senate that went first last year on climate change. That bill came to the floor just after the July 4th recess, just after senators got back from visiting with constituents who were paying $4 a gallon at the pump for regular. And as you can imagine, they were in no mood to take up a climate change bill that might lead to even higher gasoline prices. So having been through that experience, I think a lot of the members of the Senate decided that it would make more sense to sit back and give the House a chance to go first. So the Senate has been focused in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee more narrowly on just doing those parts of the President's green energy agenda that had not been completed as part of the stimulus bill and that are within that committee's jurisdiction. I think what you will see in the Senate is very little action beyond the committee on energy until well into this fall. And the reason is that I think you will see the Senate focused principally on health care reform in the interim, and you may see, and I'm not sure what Nick said in the first part of the program about Supreme Court nomination and the review by the Senate, but that could take up a few weeks of Senate floor time as well. So,
yeah, he indeed said that, and the question is whether or not it'll be August or September. Well, Jeff, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, some of the battles that are going on here in the country over this bill, and I want to shift the focus to a little more worldwide perspective. My poolside reading this month has been the new Thomas Friedman book, Flat, Hot, and Crowded, which is the follow-up to his bestseller, The World is Flat. And he spends a lot of time sort of talking about the strategic advantages that would come if the United States was out in front on the green revolution, although we currently trail a lot of developed nations, especially those in Western Europe. The president's obviously touring the world. He's just gotten on a flight from Egypt on his way to Western Europe today. Tell me a little bit about how you think foreign nations view the American proposal on cap and trade, and what will they do legislatively to react to that?
A great question. There is a conference now scheduled for December in Copenhagen under the auspices of the United Nations. All the major developed and developing countries with an interest in climate change will be there. The goal of the conference is to develop a successor to the Kyoto Protocol, which is the worldwide agreement in place now that lays down the framework for climate change initiatives. You may recall that the United States refused to participate in the Kyoto Protocol. So at this point in time, the rest of the world, both developed and developing countries, are looking at the United States for leadership. There is a recognition throughout the world that unless and until the United States is prepared to put a cap on greenhouse gas emissions, that there really is no reasonable prospect of coming up with a good successor to Kyoto. What I think you will see happening over the next 6 months is the administration talking about the need for developed and developing countries to come together on a consensus approach. But in the end of the day, we don't think the Copenhagen discussions will lead to a final deal. And that's in part because we don't think the United States Congress will have, by December, agreed to climate change legislation. As we've been discussing, the House will take up a bill. We think the House will pass a bill, but we don't see the Senate taking up anything like the House bill and not doing anything in the interim on any other kind of climate change legislation. So the net effect is you will have a process probably play out for the next 2 or 3 years in which the U.S. will make progress. There will be progress through these multilateral discussions. And by around 2011-2012, I think you'll see a convergence of interests between developed and developing countries. The major issue for developing countries is how to pay for the technology that they will need to invest in to reduce their carbon emissions. From the perspective of the United States and other Western governments, there simply isn't any money for financial transfer of assistance. So the U.S. government will be looking for ways to provide incentives for the private sector to invest in developing countries. And the other major issue to be addressed is what kind of a regime will China and India agree to. I think you will find that the U.S. Congress, the Senate in particular, is not going to be prepared to accept a final bill unless and until
they know China
has agreed to something comparable in India as well. And that the fear there among senators who represent in particular Rust Belt states is that if the U.S. Adopts stringent caps at a time when countries such as China and India do not have such kind of caps in place, that jobs will simply be exported because the manufacturers will have an incentive to move factories from carbon-constrained to carbon-free.
I want to talk about that because certainly the Friedman book and a lot of other commentators have been weighing in about one of the consequences of a poorly implemented cap-and-trade system just in the United States could be a trade war as we respond by putting tariffs on,
right.
At large emitters and their products that they continue to ship here, so we could try and balance out the need for policy change with the potential loss of manufacturing jobs in particular.
Exactly, and there have been quite a few bills introduced in the House. There has been extensive discussion focused on this particular issue. One of the ways that Chairman Waxman has tried to address the issue in the near term is to provide some of these allowances, 15% of them, in fact, to trade-sensitive industries like steel. So there's been a reason that we've gone from 100% auctioning of allowances to, 85% being given away for free. One of those reasons is to make sure that there are allowances that are made available to those industries that face the greatest threat from imports. There are other measures included in the bill that give the president authority a couple decades from now to continue to provide allowances beyond the point at which they otherwise would be phased out and to take other measures to help workers and communities that face the threat of imports from countries that do not have comparable measures in place. I think what you will see is this fight become far more intense in the Senate, and I would imagine that you will see major initiatives to put in place border adjustment mechanisms, tariff mechanisms that will essentially require importers to cover the carbon content of the goods they are importing if they are importing those goods from countries that do not have a comparable cap and trade system in place.
That siren you hear in the background, folks, is the carbon police coming to get Jeff right now. Jeff, let me shift back here to the shores of the United States and ask you to talk a little bit about any changes you see the Obama administration's put in place in the first 6 months or about to come on the issue of energy exploration here for our domestic supply.
The only thing the administration has done probably would end up discouraging production if it's adopted, and that's the administration has put forward a proposal to eliminate or repeal or scale back significantly all of the tax breaks that have been included in the Internal Revenue Code for decades to encourage domestic oil and gas production. So you see a major fight underway in the Congress now over whether those provisions should be eliminated, scaled back, further adjusted so that the industry still has the incentive to go in, especially in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, and invest billions of dollars in the hope of finding oil or gas. As part of the debate on the energy bill in the Senate, I expect that you will see a debate over expanding production offshore the United States. The moratorium that had blocked offshore production outside of Louisiana and Texas for the last couple of decades lapsed last year. So there's nothing stopping from exploration, but then again, the administration would have to authorize it. It hasn't done so. But there is a mood in the Congress to at least look for, you know, the possibility of OCS production, say, off the coast of Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, if those governors and state legislatures want to go in that direction. But it's going to be very modest, and one of the things I'm sure you'll hear when the House climate bill is on the House floor, and then when an energy bill gets to the Senate floor, I'm sure you'll hear Republicans saying there's no energy in this energy bill.
Right. That would probably be a bad sign. I've seen some sniping back and forth. Jim Clyburn, who's the House Majority Whip, seems to be very concerned that there's not yet enough nuclear in the House side bill. You see much changing about that?
Well, they did. During the debate on the climate change bill, the very first amendment the committee took up was one offered by Mr. Dingell of Michigan and other senior Democrats on the committee that would put in place incentives for the government to help support new nuclear construction and more renewable development, more renewable energy. The goal here has been to step in where the market has not been willing to provide financing, and so the proposed legislation that Mr. Dingell put forward, adopted by the committee, includes new loans, loan guarantees, and other financing mechanisms to ensure to bring more renewables to market, including new nuclear facilities.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us. We'll be back with more in just a minute.
Thank you.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, good afternoon. Just a little bit of time left in the show. I want to thank Nick Allard and Jeff Turner for being our guests today, talking about the Supreme Court nomination process and the energy bill. It's one of the more fascinating topics before the United States Congress and the Obama administration right now. It's a topic that will, that if passed, will create fundamental changes in the way we do business here in the United States and the way we consume energy in the future. So definitely something we keep our eye on every day. Well, I want to talk a little bit of politics with our time remaining. Democrats perhaps in trouble in two key states. There are only two gubernatorial elections in 2009. One's right here at home in my own state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the other's in New Jersey, both of which have some news this week. New Jersey had a primary. We've got a Republican nominee up there who's a former federal prosecutor, and he's running against the incumbent Democratic governor. That's John Corzine. John Corzine, interestingly enough, is somebody who actually endorsed his Democratic opponent, Mr. Christie, when Mr. Christie was a nominee for the federal attorney's job there. And so they have a history. What's interesting about the primary is Governor Corzine had his own primary. He ran against a couple of folks that weren't well known and certainly were not well financed. When you consider Corzine is a former head of Goldman Sachs and is sitting on a personal fortune measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and yet the sitting governor won less than 80% of the primary this week. And that's a sure sign of weakness, a sure sign that many of the party are unhappy with him. Meanwhile, Christie is the more moderate Republican, and he won the primary against a fairly conservative sitting mayor. And now we're going to have a great battle in New Jersey. It's interestingly, the Obama narrative will be turned around. The message of change will be on the Republican side as they seek to attack a state government that has basically continued to run up a tab and created an environment that seems to be driving off business and seems to be turning off taxpayers who are voting with their feet and moving to Pennsylvania or moving further south or moving further west. In one poll I saw, New Jersey is actually rated the least business-friendly environment in the United States, and that's obviously going to be a significant issue in this election. Now, what Governor Corzine has going for him is he's got a valuable, large political machine behind him. He's got virtually unlimited funds to the extent that he wants to continue to invest his own money in his reelection chance, and all indications are he will spend tens of millions of dollars again to get reelected, and he can launch an onslaught of negative ads against his Republican opponent. He actually had some ads running in the primary in the hopes he could get the more conservative candidate nominated by the Republicans and would have given him a little easier path. But those states are usually bellwethers. You remember Republicans set large with Christy Todd Whitman a decade ago when she was the governor in New Jersey. Now, let's turn to Virginia for a minute. Got a primary there Tuesday. Republicans don't have but one candidate. That's Bob McDonnell, who's the attorney general, stepped down to run for governor, and he is running with unified support of the entire party. We've got a three-way primary on the Democratic side that is just fascinating. You've got Terry McAuliffe, who used to be the head of the Democratic National Committee, has tons of ties to the Clintons. He was Hillary's campaign chairman, used to raise money for the Clintons, was head of the DNC under the Clintons, well-connected to all the big money in the Democratic Party nationwide, and he's been attacked for essentially being a carpetbagger to the race, according to the other two Democratic candidates, and for raising so much of his money out of state. Now, the two folks he's facing off against, Brian Moran, who is an Alexandria state delegate from Alexandria, one of the population centers in Northern Virginia, and whose brother is a Democratic congressman from that area, and Cray Deeds, who's from the southwestern part of the state, longtime member of the Virginia State House. I've seen polls this week that essentially have this anybody's race. Everybody's polling in the mid to high 20s, depending on Moran's released a poll that shows him in the lead. There's been a public poll that shows Deeds in the lead. Polling last week showed McAuliffe in the lead. And essentially, they've all got money to spend, about at least $1 million to burn here in the last week or so of the election. And if you're watching Virginia TV, you know they're up with a lot of ads attacking one another. This is expected to be a very low turnout race, but it'll be very interesting to see. Terry McAuliffe is benefiting from the fact that there are two anti-McAuliffe candidates in the race, and their votes may get split amongst them. If there were just one of them in the race, I think McAuliffe would have a tougher time coming through this plurality election. But I think at the end of the day, you still have to favor McAuliffe. He's got the most money to spend in the next week, motivating people to get out, educating people about his positions. It will be an upset if he's not the nominee on Tuesday night, if either Deeds or Moran squeak through in this election. If McAuliffe doesn't win, well, that's another big blow to the Clinton-era machine in the Democratic Party. President Obama stayed out of this race, as have most of his supporters and surrogates. Both of Virginia's Democratic senators have stayed out of the race, and Tim Kaine, who's the head of the Democratic National Committee and the Virginia governor, seems to have basically stayed out as well, sort of holding their powder to see who is in there, who's going to win. So that's fascinating. Going to set up a great election for the fall in both those two states that if Republicans win, they'll say that's the start of the turnaround. If Democrats win, they will say it's more evidence that that the Democratic message is the message that people want in government. So these are two elections that matter a lot more than they normally would. A couple other interesting political notes. You may have seen that the president appointed a new Secretary of the Army. It's John McHugh, a Republican member of Congress from upstate New York. Now, another brilliant move by the president, appointing a Republican from a swing political district to a plum job in the Obama administration. McHugh served several terms, has been a key player on the Armed Services Committee, and you may say, well, why is he jumping out? Well, it's no fun to be in the minority in the House of Representatives. You basically get told, here's what we're voting on, show up and vote, but you don't get much input into the process. And McHugh's also from a district. If you remember, the state of New York looks like it's likely to lose a couple electoral votes in the next census. And his district was probably in danger of being eradicated by a democratically controlled state assembly. So he probably thought, hey, I'll get out now instead of wait a couple years and find out that my district is being eliminated and I'd have to run against a Democratic incumbent in order to keep my seat in the future. Let me turn down to North Carolina. You see Democrats continuing to look for a top-line challenger to vulnerable Republican incumbent Senator Richard Burr. They've been turned down by the State Attorney General, Cooper, but they're trying to get Cooper back in the race. They're looking at Heath Shuler. You may remember Heath Shuler as being an outstanding University of Tennessee quarterback and then played for the Redskins before injuries cut short his career. He's now second-term congressman from Western North Carolina, well-funded guy, who's taking a look at the race. But they're undoubtedly going to find somebody to run against Burr, and I think North Carolina is going to be one of those bellwether states in North in 2010 that tells us a lot about whether or not the Obama revolution has legs. We'll be back next week to talk more about these issues. Until then, keep it here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.